This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
It's so hard to talk about this, David, because it's like I'm like flipping from show to show. Everyone should be talking about Fleabag.
They're talking about dragons all the time.
Don't get me started. I'm not the world's biggest Game of Thrones fan. Actually, do you watch Barry?
I do a little bit.
Barry is an interesting show because Barry had a very straightforward second season.
You know, if you're going to talk about TV with Emily Nussbaum, the New Yorker's television critic, you'd better wake up early and you better do your homework. I don't know how Emily has the time for all the shows she's watched while writing for the magazine and winning a Pulitzer Prize for criticism while she's at it. It's no small feat. But one thing Emily always pays attention to is how television shows can process and reflect on what's happening in the world around us. Emily, you've got an essay in this week's New Yorker about Me Too and television. You call Me Too a deluge of plot lines in television. Why a deluge and how does it show itself up?
The Me Too movement was a pivot for me because I feel like one of the things that was happening was that, first of all, the Me Too movement affected Hollywood and the television industry. So what you started seeing were plots that were not so much about acts of sexual violence or acts of harassment, which is a whole different subject, but about people considering their own collusion within the larger system. So some of these are very ambitious and interesting plots, and some of these are rude jokes on comedies. But for a while, when I was watching TV, there was pretty much not a single show that I could think of, especially among comedies, soap operas, and things like that, that didn't have a plot like this. There was a very interesting example on The Good Fight, which is a CBS show that had an episode this year that was called the one about the recent troubles that was kind of hard to miss as a reference to CBS. So what was fascinating—
This is the Les Moonves
After Les Moonves stepped down, The Good Fight, which is about a law firm, had an episode in which the much regarded leader of the law firm turns out to have committed numerous acts of violent sexual harassment within the company. And the whole cast, who are sort of our heroes, turn around and basically there's a fusillade of NDAs and they're just trying to shut the whole thing down.
Carl Reddick was a complicated man. People who change history and do good are not all good.
This firm could lose 40% of its clients.
Yeah, but we didn't do anything wrong. We didn't cover anything up. But if we pay someone off, it becomes our scandal.
Do we know we haven't paid already?
What do you mean?
I looked at Reddick's contract. In 2012, we made a deal to cover all of his sexual harassment lawsuits.
It was standard CEO protection.
I thought that was a very interesting plot to have on CBS.
and not without some courage.
Yes. All over TV, you can see these reflections of what's going on within TV. But what was striking to me, again, was the fact that a lot of these plots and jokes were thoughtful, rich, provocative, sometimes rude. I start the essay with a piece about Tuca and Birdie, which is a new animated show by Lisa Hannawalt, who does the animation for BoJack Horseman. Tuca and Birdie is sort of it's a friendship show. It's an animated show set in a loopy world in which everybody's a bird. And in a lot of ways, it's very bouncy and funny. But there's a central plot on it that has to do with Birdie, who is the main character, who is a kind of shy, anxious bird. And she gets a job with this penguin who is a master chef. And she has a huge crush on him. But he also does this kind of humiliating physical thing to her. He pushes her face over a stove that's something that he's cooking, and basically gets behind her and pushes her very close to it. So it's one of those weird incidents that I think she finds hard to define to herself. By the way, I realize for anyone, I'm spoiling Tuca and Birdie. You're just going to have to live with it. A younger apprentice gets hired, and when he does the same thing to her, she has a completely different reaction. It's a classic generational split.
Hey, are you okay?
Can you believe he just grabbed me like that? Has he ever done anything like that before?
No. I mean, sort of.
Wait, did he grab you too?
You don't understand.
It's just part of the job and how he teaches. He's very passionate. Why are you defending him?
I'm not trying to... I don't know.
And you didn't warn me. You know what he did was wrong, right? I looked up to you.
But she's furious because she's basically like says to Birdie, you didn't protect me, you didn't warn me that he was like this. And it kind of sends her into a tailspin.
So how does that go over with the audience? I'm finding, so there was the Me Too journalism moment, right, in which big, powerful men doing obviously horrible things are rightly brought low. There's that moment. We could name Les Moonves, Harvey Weinstein, et cetera, et cetera. And then comes the moment, and you start seeing it in fiction. We've published a couple of stories ourselves, Zadie Smith, another one coming from Mary Gateskill, in which the terms of complicity and guilt and innocence and responsibility and all those issues are much more complicated.
Are muddied by...
And the reaction to those kind of narratives is at least my reading of certainly social media, is much more complicated.
How have people reacted to it? I actually don't know that.
Well, some people will say this is wrong. I mean, this is not the moment for that
This is
level
a clear-cut situation, and people shouldn't talk about complicated.
Exactly. How is that playing on television?
I mean, so far, I have to say, I don't think that people have had bad reactions to these plots.
Because they're animated or because they're fictional?
But the thing is, they're not just animated. Like, there was a plot about this kind of thing on Veep. There was a plot, I mean...
What was the Veep story?
The Veep story was... I mean, Veep is a deeply cynical show, and everybody on it acts like an asshole nonstop. And so it is unsurprising that in the age of Me Too, the female main character of the show would weaponize the possibilities of Me Too. And one of the things she did at the very end, as the series was ending, was that... She was going to be beat in the presidential race, and she was sort of taunted by her opponent, Tom, who was also her ex-lover and her ex-vice president, because the show is like that. But he was sleeping with his chief of staff, and she essentially just goes to the chief of staff, and in a really cutting, remarkable speech, she sells the chief of staff on redefining the affair as harassment.
I just hate to see smart women throw away their political careers on powerful men who only see them as the gash of least resistance. I mean, you strike me as a smart woman, are you?
There are a lot of shows that are comedies that have attempted to do these kind of dark, backwards jokes on the whole thing. And I like a lot of those jokes. I think they're funny. It's true that if... all of TV was nothing but jokes about false accusations, that would feel a little ugly. But I don't think that's the case.
Comedies.
Yes.
Not dramas. More comedies than dramas. Why would that be?
I am curious about this myself. I mean, the shows that I talk about, with some exceptions, there are exceptions to this, but that I've really noticed this on are comedies, soap operas, telenovela-type shows, romantic comedy kinds of things. I do think that maybe there's been a hesitation to deal with this head-on in drama because drama does, to some extent at least, require sincerity, and sincerity can be uncomfortable in talking about trauma and assault. I do think that there's a specific thing that has to do with workplace comedies, which is a lot of sitcoms, and shows that have a female audience and have to do with the main female character in romances seem to have been particularly affected by this. And I think part of that is because workplace comedies have always had things that now look like sexual harassment baked into them. You can't watch Cheers now and not see that there's something a little weird about the dynamic between Sam and Diane. It feels different now, like Sam's hostility to her seems more power-driven.
Sam, could I ask a little off-the-cuff question?
Sure.
Who took me home last night, you or Carla?
You don't remember?
No.
We both did.
Who put my pajamas on?
Carla did.
Oh, you'd already left by that time, right?
No. I was still there.
You mean watching?
No. I was in the other room minding my own business. On my good behavior. Trying on your lingerie.
The show seems designed to romanticize sexual harassment. That's an extremely limited and prudish way of looking at Cheers, which is a brilliant sitcom. But it's hard to ignore that it's kind of baked into the design of certain shows.
But you're saying that Cheers would not, to some degree, is that we wouldn't see Cheers now in the year 2019. That whole dynamic between the boss bartender and the waitress wouldn't come off.
It's hard to say because it's true that I think if you made a modern version of that, people would be a little more aware of the fact that him being her direct
report
in the bar would feel different. I don't know. I mean, it's funny. I was just watching a show. It's called Kim's Convenience. It's a really wonderful Canadian show with one of my kids. And he was disturbed that one of the bosses was flirting with one of the employees on the show because I feel like
it's, one of your sons was disturbed.
Yeah, because I feel like he has absorbed the strong message that anybody who does this is being exploitative. And I was like, well, you know, it's a comedy and he likes her too. You know, it's just interesting. I mean, people look at things in different ways. I'm trying to think if there's been, I mean, you know, frankly, a lot of shows have just thrown in a joke about it. So you have, I love the sitcom The Other Two, and there are a million moments on that show where somebody realizes they're doing something a little sexually weird, and they say, well, you know, in the current climate
being the working phrase,
they just nervously say, in the current climate that really wouldn't go, like stuff like that.
Okay, so how about the biggest show in the world? We've heard about The Other Two, but how about the biggest show in the world, Game of Thrones? Where's the Me Too element in Game of Thrones?
Well, look, Game of Thrones, what a complicated text, literally set in a raposphere. So, like, the show is about that.
In Westeros, no Me Too.
This is a problem with writing about anything with Me Too, is it ends up being this very weird, reductive thing. Like,
right.
Of course, it's a show about sexual violence. It's, to me, a weirdly disappointing show in a lot of ways in terms of its engagement with a lot of the ideas about gender, but it also has all these badass women in it. I mean, the notion of a badass woman on TV is a very boring notion, and it's like some of the most boring shows are centered around this idea that the way that you resolve issues of sexism is to create a kick-ass woman who's badass and everyone can be like, yeah, team her. That's stupid. Like, that doesn't make for good art at all. But luckily, we're living in a period when there are a lot of female television creators making shows ranging from, you know, Fleabag, Broad City, which had its own little Me Too thing on it. And those are not shows that have plastic, badass female characters on them. I mean, I don't like shows like that.
So now we've talked about this in the office a little bit already. You've got a new book that's about to come out, I Like to Watch, and you took some time to get the book together right smack in the middle of the Me Too movement.
Yes. My book leave took place for 3 months in the fall of 2017, and the Weinstein pieces came down. And honestly, I don't think I was the only one who felt this way, but I really couldn't think about anything else. It was a cataclysmic psychological experience. And so instead of writing what I was planning to write, I ended up writing a long, extensive essay that I'm proud of that is partially a personal essay, partially an essay about separating the artist from the art and that whole question for critics, for people, ethically, emotionally, and partially a kind of an account of my own relationship with the work of men who do bad things, you know, and
for
bad
example,
boy
we,
art.
What kind of men, what men are we talking about who do bad things?
I mean,
this
is a complicated subject, but sure. I start with the fact that I was a major Woody Allen fan from the time I was a little kid. I mean, he's really formed my sensibility very deeply.
And where do you come down on somebody like Woody Allen? Do you watch the new work? Do you now have revulsion for the previous work? How do you regard it?
I mean, it varies depending on the person. I am not a big fan of cancel people and don't read their stuff.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, I actually don't have a problem with people losing their platform in an economic way. I'm talking as a critic, this is my role. My role is to engage with art. I feel like I can't erase art. I have a whole section in there on Bill Cosby. And part of it's about the fact that I was never a big Bill Cosby fan, so it wasn't a big personal thing for me to lose Bill Cosby the way it was for some people I know. But The Cosby Show is central to TV history. Without Bill Cosby, it's very hard to understand things like Black-ish in Atlanta, which are responses in some ways to what Bill Cosby was doing. Bill Cosby's relationship with the Roseanne show at the time is crucial to TV history. Bill Cosby basically paved the way for all of the Black sitcoms that followed him, and many of which went away. But and frankly, his role as this prominent male feminist, which is honestly what he was during that period, had this enormous influence on people's ideas about race, about class, all these kinds of things. So it's definitely more comfortable to act as though The Cosby Show didn't exist and never think about it, but I think that's short-sighted. I did want to talk about one show that I pinpoint as doing something I found really exceptional and very interesting, which was High Maintenance, which is a show on HBO that I'd loved for a long time.
The Stoner Show that became about a guy who
the
goes around.
The Stoner Show.
Oh, well, a guy who goes around on a bicycle selling pot all over the city. And it started out on Vimeo.
Yes,
right?
It started on Vimeo, and I feel like the show.
I
love the show, and I feel like it's been very transformative for television. Television, which is largely based on half-hour or hour-long shows, High Maintenance is a kind of drifty indie filmish show that's very visual. It was one of the early anthology shows, so generally each episode is separate. But since it's been on HBO, it's added in a little bit of seriality, and I found this season fascinating because I don't think a lot of people talked about this, but there was kind of a Me Too plot woven through the episodes. It wasn't made central. It wasn't dealt with in any way as like a big polemical thing. But the main character, the guy, starts dating this woman. She's going through a divorce, and it slowly comes out over the course of the season, just in dribs and drabs, small scenes, scraps of dialogue, that she was married to a movie actor or TV actor, it's a little unclear, who's committed some kind of Me Too crime. The whole show ends up being about the conversations that circle this, but it's not a huge part of the show. And then at the very end of the show, he talks to an old friend of his in a beautiful episode that's the first one I think that's been set in Manhattan because it's generally set in Brooklyn. And basically what he wants to talk to her about is something that's clearly been haunting him the whole season, which is an incident in which he pulled down her pants when they were in high school.
What?
You were watching the talent show, and you were standing up front enjoying yourself, and I came up behind you, and you were wearing pajama pants. And I pantsed you, but I didn't know you weren't wearing underwear, and everyone saw. And I really felt bad about it my entire life. What? What are you laughing
at? Are you kidding? I have no memory of that.
Really? You were so...
Was I? I have no recollection.
I've been sweating this for like 20 years. And you're telling me, dude, you know, I might have done a lot of drugs, but you have a really shitty memory.
And he's clearly thought about this in a post-Me Too way as, is this the shitty thing that I did that traumatized a woman that I know and that I'm responsible for, and how do I take responsibility for it? So they have this conversation
about it. But that's a rare thing. My impression, and I don't watch quite as many shows as a professional TV critic, but it seems to me that there don't seem to be a lot of plot lines about men grappling with their own transgressions.
Well, this is one thing I found really lovely about this, is that it was not only a man grappling with a transgression, but it was also a small story, not a big story. It wasn't about some larger-than-life anti-hero grappling with world-bestriding crimes. Mm. It was about just an ordinary guy kind of thinking about his history. Really, the ideal thing about the movement, aside from deposing terrible people who've done horrible things, is also having fresh eyes to be able to look at the world. And the best shows that are doing this seem to me to be doing something I find really admirable in artists, which is the ability to shift and adjust and have fresh eyes on the world and try to say something that's neither simply like go girl affirmative or kind of a hackneyed gag, and actually say something original.
Emily Nussbaum,
Thank you.
Thanks.
Emily Nussbaum is the television critic for The New Yorker, and she's got a book coming out called, and I love this title, I Like to Watch. Down the line, I'm going to talk with her again about the rise of antiheroes on television, beloved characters who do bad or truly awful things, and how we might be better off without them. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Ava DuVernay is probably best known for the movie Selma. It's a wrenching but finally triumphant story about the Alabama Civil Rights March led by Dr. King in 1965. But DuVernay's films have not always been so uplifting. 2 years after Selma, she released 13th, named for the 13th Amendment. She draws a very direct connection between slavery and mass incarceration in our own time. Her new film also looks at justice and race in a way that can rightfully be called tragic, a four-part miniseries called When They See Us. When They See Us is about the five teenagers whose lives were nearly destroyed after they were accused and convicted of a terrible crime in 1989. They became known as the Central Park Five. One of Donald Trump's first political acts, this was 30 years ago, was to take a newspaper ad out calling for their execution. And Trump stuck by that view even after New York City admitted that the conviction of the five boys was wrong, exonerated them, and paid them a settlement. Ava DuVernay recently sat down to talk about her film with New Yorker staff writer Jelani Cobb.
So can you just walk us through what happened on the night of April 19th, 1989?
Sure. On the night of April 19th, 1989, five black and brown boys were picked up in and around Central Park, both that night and the next morning. The first boys that were picked up for being boys, will be boys in the park, hanging out, loitering, unlawful assembly. Those are some of the things that they were picked up for when you go back and look at the police records. Mm-hmm. It was a large group, 30 to 40 boys in the park, who were also messing with bicyclists and harassing and catcalling bicyclists. That was what they were brought in for. The next morning, early in the morning, it's revealed that a woman has been raped in the park and she's near dead. She's been brutalized in the most horrific way. And while in the police department, an assumption is made that the boys who were in the park hanging out were the same people who raped the woman who was found on another side of the park. And so there started to be this attempt to put these two pieces of the puzzle together. And eventually the 30 went down to 5. And those 5 boys were interrogated. They didn't know details of the jogger. They didn't know her race. They didn't know where she was. They didn't know what she was wearing. They didn't know anything about it. Through multiple days of coercion, deprived food, bathroom breaks, parental supervision, the boys eventually ended up saying that they did it, that they were, in fact, with the jogger, that they did, in fact, rape her in an attempt to just get home, which was what was promised.
Arrested within hours of the attack, 5 teens, 4 black, 1 Latino, all charged with the brutal rape of a 28-year-old jogger in New York's Central Park.
And so from there, they became the Central Park Five, and the whole city of New York turned against them. The national press, began writing about them as a wolf pack of wilding animals that assaulted this woman, and they went to prison.
So how did that connection happen between these young men who are on a different side of the park and this woman who was violated horrifically? What leads people to believe that there's a connection between these two incidents?
I mean, what leads them to believe it? It certainly wasn't DNA evidence, because there was never any. There was no physical evidence tying the boys to Trisha Miley, who's the victim, the rape victim. There was no hair samples in common, no skin under her fingernails in common with the boys, no weapon ever found. And she was obviously beaten with something that was never found from these boys on her, and nothing from her on them. From the minute they were picked up in the park, they were immediately taken into the precinct. They had no blood on them, but she was completely bloody. So all of these details didn't fit, and yet the police made them fit, to the point that these boys were arrested, tried, and convicted of sodomy, rape, assault, attempted murder. And one of them, Corey Wise, he went immediately to an adult prison, because in New York State,
and how old was he?
He was 16. He went immediately into Rikers and didn't come out again for 14 years.
And how long were the other 4?
A range of 5 to 8 years.
Talk to me a little bit about what the city was like at that point. Like, what was the context in which this happened?
Well, you know.
Yeah, I know, but the middle, you know.
You were here. I had to research it.
I was here.
But, you know, I'm from Compton, and I was like, damn, it was rough here. It was very, just a high crime. When you look at the crime rates, you know, the rates of murder and assault and rape, I mean, the city was, it was a city in chaos. And in the midst of that, there was an attempt to create some order. Create some kind of framing device, I believe, for all of the chaos, for the police, for law enforcement, for the district attorney's office, the prosecutors, all of them, to be able to get a win on the board, because there was just so many losses, so much going wrong. You know, Trisha Miley, who was so brutally assaulted, was in some ways, and is described by a journalist that I talked to, she was the perfect victim. Her victimization, you know, really fell into certain tropes, certain racial stereotypes and tropes in terms of her rape and, you know, black men and the rape of white women. And there was this kind of protector stance that was taken, and not just by the police, but by journalists. I mean, there was a study done, 89% of the press coverage at that time from the major New York papers didn't use the word alleged. And so it was a rush to judgment. And in the midst of all of that, and so many parts of that story you can tell, you had 5 boys and their families.
So I've read that Raymond Santana reached out to you via Twitter.
Yeah.
And wanted you to tell their story. And Raymond Santana is one of the falsely accused young men.
Yes. Raymond Santana runs an account called Central Park 5. And so shortly after Selma, 2015, I got a tweet asking, what is your next film after Selma? ? Central Park 5? # fingers crossed.
Wow.
And so I had just seen Sarah Burns' beautiful documentary about it a few months before, and I DM'd him. I slid into his DMs, and I said, does no one have your story? Mm-hmm. The narrative rights to your story? And he said, no. And I said, well, I'm going to be in New York in a couple months. Maybe we can connect. Mm-hmm. So we set about our journey to make it.
There's a really powerful scene where four of the five young men are in the same room for the first time. And they begin talking and very quickly realize that they've all been pressured to implicate each other. They've all been pressured to lie on each other.
They made us lie. Right?
And Kevin Richardson, the character, says, why they do us like this? And Raymond Santana's character in response says, what other way they ever do us?
What other way they ever do us?
Was this a conversation that the young men remembered, or was this something that you wrote based upon what you understood to have happened then?
No, that was real. They mm-hmm. really, they speak in very detailed, specific, emotional ways about the first time they all met, the day that they met each other, the moment that they met in the interrogation room when they introduce themselves to each other. And at the same time that's happening, they're being painted as a wolf pack gang on the outside of the precinct. Mm. They talked about in that moment really making a pact, which is not in the film. I shot it, but I didn't include it. They make a pact in their real memory in that room to never lie again. And I just think that's extraordinary. You're talking about 14, 15-year-olds in there. Kind of reconciling this traumatic experience, apologizing to one another, and banding together, and they stuck to it.
Were there any aspects of the story that were off limits?
With them, no. Mm-hmm. No, they were very, very open. In the final part of the film, you'll see a piece about Corey Wise's trans sister. Mm-hmm. And in all my interviews with him, he never talked about his trans sister. Mm-hmm. I found out about his sister, and it made its way into the film through the family member of another man who said, oh, I used to be in class with Norman. And I was like, who's Norman? Corey's brother. And I was like, oh, yeah, Corey does have a brother named Norman. I'm looking. And so I went back and I asked Corey, can you tell me about your brother Norman? And he said, oh, you mean my brother Marcy. And that's something that, as we were talking, he didn't tell me about, but it was never off limits, mm-hmm. right? Just wasn't being presented in a story at that moment. And so as I would find different pieces of the guy's stories, sometimes through other people, I could always bring it back to them, and they were always an open book.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the artistry for a minute, which is, one, there are some really phenomenal performances in this film. And I wondered what your casting process was like and what you were looking for in terms of performance.
Gosh, this is the biggest cast I've ever worked with. It was 179 cast members, 117 speaking parts.
Wow.
My film before this, A Wrinkle in Time, had six cast members. The biggest piece was The Boys. Mm. What we were going to do about these boys. It kept me up at night. I would find the right boy, but couldn't find a man to match him, right? Because the boys had to grow up to be men. Mm-hmm. I'd find a great guy, a great man, but there was no kid I found that looked like that guy, mm-hmm. so I had to let him go. So I was just at one point just going in circles, just dreaming about, you know, boys and men and mm-hmm. pairings and just it's panicking. But we got it done, and something I'm really very proud of. When you speak of artistry and then you went straight to the casting, I thank you for that.
So there's a scene. It's interesting. You refer to it as a film. I think people would think of it as a series because it's four parts, but you think of it as a discrete
Jelani,
film.
Jelani, I'm a filmmaker, okay?
Uh-huh.
I'm a filmmaker. I'm a serious auteur. I didn't make this like a series. I made it like a film.
Mm-hmm.
This is the rhythm of the production, the time that you're spending in post, the time that you're spending in prep. I really went into it with my film tool built as opposed to television.
But there's a scene, you know, a pivotal scene when the mother of Yousef Salaam arrives at the police precinct to retrieve her son. And the police were in the middle of trying to get him to sign away his rights to an attorney. Before leaving the interrogation room, Yousef's mother approaches the only woman in the room, and that woman is Linda Fairstein. And she questions her ethics, essentially.
Are you already interrogating my son back there without me? He is too young for that.
He is a minor.
You can't stop us from interrogating a suspect. Who do you think you are?
I'm his mother. And I'm stopping this. I'm stopping this right now. Right now, I want to see my son. I want to see my son right now. Right now.
The woman that you're speaking about is Sharon Salam, who was a mighty warrior mother for her child, Yusuf Salam. He was the only boy that did not make a false confession. Mm-hmm. He did not. His coercion never was completed because she was able to get inside of the interrogation room and pull him out, which I just think is extraordinary. The story of Yusuf Salam is the one that is even more insane because he had no confession. Mm-hmm. So he had no confession, he had no physical evidence, and he still went away. And so with this piece, yes, it is about this very famous case, the Central Park Five case, the Central Park Jogger case. But the overall goal for me, in addition to telling the story of these men, which was first and foremost, was to tell the story of what it means to be criminalized in this country and how that happens. So it's designed to take you through the whole terrain of the criminal justice system. The first part of the film deals with police interaction, police aggression, the precinct environment. The second part of the film deals with court, trial, defense attorneys, prosecution, juries, bail. The third part of the film deals with juvenile detention and then also post-incarceration, all the ways that we treat formerly incarcerated people as second-class citizens in this country. And the fourth piece is a deep dive dedicated to the incarceration experience itself, particularly issues around solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. And so within that, while watching this, you're watching about this case that was a very famous case, but you're going to come out with a little bit of knowledge about all of those pieces of the puzzle. And so for me, it's a bit of a companion piece to 13th, which was talking a lot about the history of criminalization and how we got here, but this piece, I want to talk about what it is, all the levers of the system that keep so many people truly oppressed and ensnared in the system.
Well, it's interesting that you say this is a companion piece to 13th, because when I watched it, I thought of it as the third part of a trilogy, including your earlier film, Middle of Nowhere.
Which no one's seen except you. There were three people. You were one of them. Don't make the people feel bad.
I showed it to my class, so there's more than three people.
But yeah, it does. You're right. It does speak to Middle of Nowhere, which was an independent film that I made about a woman whose husband is incarcerated. And the point of view of the film is her. So you're never going into the prison further than she goes. You're carrying the baggage of being this invisible victim, which is the case for so many families of incarcerated people.
How close was your understanding of this issue before you started doing these stories?
I know everybody thinks I've got like a husband in prison or, you know, a brother who's, you know, locked up or something. No, it's not. It wasn't close to me in terms of family, but it was all over my community. So there were all of these, you know, people who disappeared, I remember thinking, people who were there one day and aren't there the next day in my neighborhood. Where is your daddy? Oh, he's locked up. Or where is, you know, the woman that was down the street? You know, she's gone for 2 weeks, picked up on something but couldn't get bail, so she's still locked up. I just remember hearing these stories, and it really stuck with me. It really stayed with me.
One thing stands out to me. We can go back 30 years in the context of lots of women who were assaulted that same week. Most of them were women of color. We find this one case where the police, the prosecutors, the media, the public took this sexual assault exceedingly seriously. What do you think accounts for that contrast?
Well, I think race has a lot to do with it. But also, again, I mean, they were, running with a story. You know, it's running with a story that was of great interest to the city. And they used the cipher of this kind of pristine white woman, to be honest with you, because we know that there were women of color who were, in very horrible instances, raped and attacked that very same week, that had no press coverage at all. So I can only point to race as one of the big factors, and not just race. I mean, this was a white woman who was somebody. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? She was accomplished. She was educated. Mm-hmm. She was well-liked. The journalist said to me she was perfect. She was part of a perfect story.
Mm. Has anyone from the NYPD, a prosecutor's office, apologized?
No. They've never said, oh, yeah, that was wrong. They just say that Mateus Reyes, who was the man who actually committed the rape, was the sixth guy. It should have been Central Park 6.
There's something about that that strikes me as outrageous because...
You think?
This was a person who had a track record of sexual assault. His MO was to act alone. He subsequently committed other sexual assaults alone. And in the midst of this, the prosecution's argument is that he then collaborated in this horrific assault with five young men whom he did not know at all. And he was the only person who was not captured.
Right.
That's the argument.
That's the argument. That's the argument for people who are actually, teaching law and writing books and speaking around the country as experts in law.
You're saying that the two of the prosecutors have kind of gone on to do these other
things. Yes, they've gone on to do all these things. One's a law professor, one's a crime novelist, mm-hmm. considered both to be experts in their field. And mm-hmm. Yes, that's what they contend. And no one involved in any major role in this has ever said that they were wrong, that they're sorry, that there might have been an error, that they made a mistake. Sometimes you have to call a lie a lie. Mm. This whole thing was built on a lie. Mm. It was revealed to be a lie. These men have been exonerated. That's why I don't call them the Central Park Five. I call them the Exonerated Five. Mm-hmm. That's not a good title for a movie, so we change it to When They See Us. But they're not the Central Park Five. You know, they're Corey, Yusuf, Antron, Kevin, and Raymond. And they were boys with dreams, with families, with memory that we wanted to honor and recognize in this piece.
Filmmaker Ava DuVernay. She spoke with The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb. When They See Us has just been released on Netflix. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Summer has more or less arrived, and so to close the show, we'll turn to someone who took the most profound satisfaction in just being outdoors, the late poet Mary Oliver. Oliver found meaning in the smallest details of the natural world, from geese to crabs to insects to her own dogs, and she turned to animals and to wildness for inspiration. And that close attention to nature made Mary Oliver one of the most beloved poets of our time. Here's Mary Oliver reading from The Summer Day in 2012, at the 92nd Street Y in New York City.
Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Mary Oliver died in January at 83. Not long ago, a big volume of her poetry was published called Devotions that selects from more than 50 years of her work. Ruth Franklin wrote about the book for The New Yorker. Here's Franklin speaking in 2018 with David Haglund, the features editor of NewYorker.com.
Ruth, I'm curious, when did you first read Mary Oliver's work? And do you remember whether you liked her work right away, or did it take a while?
You know, I don't have a distinct memory of the first time. I did have a boyfriend in college who was a big fan of Mary Oliver and pressed her on me, so I'm suspecting that must have been it. You know, I've always been sort of an on-and-off reader of poetry. Sometimes I go through phases where I'm in the mood for it and others where poetry in general speaks to me less. There, I did always respond to just the directness of her approach. It feels so immediate and sort of focused on you as the reader.
It's so unguarded, mm-hmm. I think. There's something, and I admit that for me, I sometimes, it sort of takes me aback. It's not what I'm used to with poetry. One of my favorite poets is Wallace Stevens, who once said that poetry should resist the intelligence almost successfully, which is just not at all her approach, I don't think.
Yeah, in general, I think that is what makes her work so almost universally appealing, is that, you know, you don't feel like you need to have a degree in poetry in order to understand Mary Oliver.
Although that's also maybe why she hasn't gotten the critical acclaim that you might expect from a writer who's won. She has won some very big prizes,
right,
and is enormously popular as poets go. But there is a kind of looking down one's nose at her from some critics, maybe. I don't know if you'd put
definitely
it that way.
You know, I think of them as sort of more academic poetry critics, you know, who are more interested in a kind of hermetic, almost coded kind of poetry.
Do you think that she's very frank about her interest in God and in prayer, and, you know, for a particular kind of secular critic, maybe that's off-putting as well?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I mean, as in the poem we just heard, This Summer Day, there's this, you know, sort of introduction to the poem where we have a nature scene with a grasshopper. One nice detail that I read somewhere in an article about her, I don't remember where now, is that there was a real grasshopper that she used as a model, as it were, for that poem. The grasshopper was eating a slice of birthday cake at a picnic, I think. And it seemed important to her, as she explained it, that the grasshopper was, in fact, a real grasshopper drawn from the natural world. So we have this little scene, and then there's an abrupt switch in the middle of the poem, and suddenly she starts talking about prayer. But, of course, you know, if you're familiar with Mary Oliver, you know that that's in the background more or less all the time.
The Summer Day is typical of her work in another way, in that it's largely about the natural world. And at least for me, living in New York City, it does feel like a window into a kind of side of life that I maybe don't get to enjoy as often as I would. And I wonder if, to some extent, people kind of feel like opening a collection of Mary Oliver is like taking a walk outside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think if Mary Oliver were here with us, she would probably scold you for saying that, because, of course, it's quite possible to experience the natural world even here in New York City. You know, you can go to Central Park in the migration season and see all the different waterfowl and warblers and everything passing through. But you're right that, and I think, you know, that that's something her poetry kind of exhorts the reader to do, is to find, you know, find that moment of beauty in nature, if it's, you know, if we can call it the sublime or the spiritual or just something we might not have noticed. You know, what did she say? Attention is the beginning of devotion. That her poetic method, as she presents it, is very much about that kind of directed attention, which presumably one could experience anywhere.
Let's give the last word to Mary Oliver. Here she is reading another one of her poems, Mornings at Blackwater.
For years, every morning, I drank from Blackwater Pond. It was flavored with oak leaves and also, no doubt, the feet of ducks. And always it assuaged me from the dry bowl of the very far past. What I want to say is that the past is the past and the present is what your life is, and you are capable of choosing what that will be, darling citizen. So come to the pond or the river of your imagination or the harbor of your longing and put your lips to the world and live your life.
Mary Oliver reading Mornings at Blackwater. Oliver died this past January, and we heard Ruth Franklin and The New Yorker's David Haglund talking about her work. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, and we're going to say goodbye for now, but please make sure to tune in next time. Masha Gessen is going to join me for a look at 50 years of gay activism since the uprising at Stonewall. She's talking with historian Martin Duberman about how Stonewall gave birth to a new kind of identity politics. And Masha traveled to Ireland to meet with an asylum seeker, a gay activist who fled a repressive and homophobic government in Russia. And finally, we'll look at the complicated state of LGBTQ rights around the world. That's all next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Mengfei Chen. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.